What's up, everybody? We're here for Mudball Monday.
You want a dramatic finish, right? Which means that you have to figure out some way to have the most exciting features on your golf course work into the golf holes on 15, 16, 17, and 18.
Aesthetically, it's an amazing hole. But I'm like, look, at the end of the day, I don't care what a hole looks like. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. So we're not going to go too deep on that one. But anyway.
GL, I feel like I have to say it. The dome has collapsed. My dome has collapsed. I'm not.
When you have a central feature such as wind and not have the round become too monotonous. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Mudball Monday, episode 111. Man, it's been a lot of Mudball Mondays. Moving into Thanksgiving week. I guess it is Thanksgiving week. This is Friday before Thanksgiving week that we're recording. We will not be doing the full-blown Thanksgiving conversation this year. We did that last year. If you haven't listened to that Mudball Monday, go back and do so. That was a rowdy one. Doesn't mean there won't be any Thanksgiving talk today, but at least it won't fully be that. What we will be talking about is some golf course chat. We're going to be talking about routing versus ordering. You know, I think one of the terms you often hear people say is like that round has a really nice flow to it. Well, I think that's there are two parts to that. There's the routing of the golf course, the job that the architect did there, and then there's the order of the holes. You know, just because you have 18 great holes that are routed well, if you started on the sixth and finished on the fifth, you know, sometimes that wouldn't work out so well. I mean, maybe we should be asking the Live Boys about that. But before I get too far off the rails here, Mr. Simas, welcome to the episode. Thank you for joining me as always. Let's go straight to the dirt. You lead us off. Drinking, eating, reading, and thinking. What do you got?
What is up, man? And what's up, guys? Excited to be here.
And girls. We've got some girls.
And girls. Welcome, girls. The dirt. Drinking. I think I've had only coffee and water last night, except we were mentioning before we started recording, I recorded with Brad Gale. I don't think that episode with Brad will post until after Thanksgiving, but it's been a heavy pod week, and I really enjoyed that conversation. And it had been kind of just, in a very good way, like a slog of a week. So we sat down, and typically on recordings with guests, you know, you kind of do the niceties at the beginning and have a little chit chat, and then, you know, just trying to be respectful of people's time, trying to get the pod going and get him out of there. And then you'll chat on the back end. And he had just gone surfing and gotten back, and we were talking about the week and whatnot. And we both cracked some bevvies over the pod last night. So that was fun. But other than that, it's been water. And, of course, my good walk. I've been kind of still mixing it up. South American dark roast, Mudball half calf, cinnamon, a little bit of maple syrup from time to time, a little bit of buch, a little bit of butter, buch. So yeah, it's been rudimentary, but very nice. Eating. I picked up groceries and kind of expected to go about my normal routine this week. Ground beef, I got some interesting spices. I got this, what do you call it? Like hot chicken, spice rub. I don't know if it was Hattie B's or something else, but it's awesome. It's like when you throw the ground beef in there. I usually wait to season till we're charred up, till that first side's done. Don't know why I do it that way, but salt the same. And brother, I had a cast iron pan really hot, and I threw that hot seasoning on there, and I was like, I had to go into the other room and just cough my eyeballs out.
Yeah, that's a tough scene. I've done that way too many times.
Now, about middle of the week, we had some, we just had like a slew of meetings this week. Had some of our manufacturers in the office just had like a bunch of that Mexican food, that taco place that I mentioned, caters. We get food from them all the time. And, we were out and about a bunch, and nobody really ate a ton of it. And I took it home, and I have just been crushing these bowls for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, it seems like. I have two very large styrofoam cups each of salsa verde and like this flaming hot red salsa that I'll never finish. Like I could vacuum seal it and freeze it, and it still would probably take me a year to get through it. But I've just been doing all the combinations. I've got chicken, I've got beef, I've got this incredible shreddis. So I've just been making like, you know, ice cold shreddis on the bottom with like, you know, charred chicken and salsa verde and pickled onions and just mixing everything together. I've had a blast of a week on the eating side. Reading, I haven't read it all this week. I've been kind of preparing for guests, and one of the things that I did spend a lot of time doing this week was looking into Brad's documentaries that he's been producing. And it's really cool. I'll share a little bit more about this story here just because we focus a lot more on golf course architecture in the pod, but he's talked about on other pods just like growing the game is a little bit of a weird thing. We've talked about this before, and usually the answer if you're looking to get involved is right in front of your face, you know, and you've just got to get involved with the people who are right in front of you and make a very small but meaningful difference where you are. And he's kind of a skater guy, but also walked onto Oklahoma State and, you know, almost made it on the PGA Tour. And frequented this skate park in West Palm and went in and noticed that the kids who were there over the summer while the parents were at work just didn't really have enough food. Like summer in Florida, you're burning so many calories, and they had meals, but not enough. And started this 501c3 and filled this fridge and just kept this fridge full all summer, hung out around these kids, showed them golf and filmed a documentary about it. The 501c3 is called The Hangry Project, and the documentary is called Summer School. So it was really well done. Enjoyed watching that, and that'll occupy my fill in for the reading category. And then thinking, I just came from the gym. Didn't go to the gym this morning, and had a nice 20-minute sauna session. And this guy was in there. His name is Tarek. I ended up talking to him because he was doing handstands in there for like 3 to 5 minutes, just crushing it. And just really peaceful, like not making a whole lot of noise. I was curious. There was nobody else in there. So I was just like, hey, man. Just curious when the first time you did a handstand was. And he basically was like a trained monk and went to this school in Pakistan and had been doing yoga and handstand since he was 6. And we were talking about diet and all this stuff, and fascinating character, like really cool outlook on life. And
oh, I believe it.
Yeah, it was really cool, you know. So it doesn't happen all that often, but that kind of occupied a little bit of my thinking space. And then my goodness, TGL, I feel like I have to say it. The dome has collapsed. My dome has collapsed. I am not sure how in the next 53 days, regardless of no rent payment and the tidy strings that Tiger and Rory seem to have in that area, I still don't know how we're going to get it done. But I have a feeling that they're going to make a push at it. So I'm just fascinated to see what takes place in the next 50 days. And we will see. So I'll toss it back to you. What's your dirt, Henry Schimpf?
Well, I'm going to call bullshit on two things there. A, TGL. I'm going ahead and laying the bullshit statement out. I think TGL is bullshit.
It is bullshit.
It's not going to work. It's bullshit. It's all just like, I don't know if there's ever going to be a shot hit, frankly. I think that they just like built this thing up and now they're maybe intentionally tearing it down. It's bullshit. Also, the other thing that's bullshit that came from your dirt there, we got people out here taking way too damn many liberties with the public saunas. Like, this is a public gym. Go do your handstands and lay your like, you know, organic food talk on people in your own sauna. Like, there's a reason they make at-home saunas. I'm sure this
Yeah.
guy was great, but like, I see the same thing way too much. People in there
Right.
like fucking Wim Hofing it and all this stuff. It's like, do that shit on your own time. Like, go, you know, go dance naked if you want to, which I'm sure way too many people are doing as we speak in their own
Yes.
saunas. But like, public saunas, for the listeners of the tie, like, I'm putting out a statement. Please don't be doing handstands and Wim Hof breathing. It's bullshit. Just be in there peacefully.
Yeah, the general rules are like don't initiate conversation unless it's just you and one other person and it's very clear that it's a green light to do so. Do not Wim Hof it, as you said. Wim Hof is to be done in private. And then just don't curse in the sauna, you know? Like don't play music too loud in your headphones, you
Taking
know?
phone calls, all that sort of bullshit. There's way too much
Yeah.
of it going on, and it's a tough scene.
Sacred
Okay,
space.
we can talk about it all day.
Go.
Jumping into my dirt. So drinking. It's been a funky week of weather. We were talking about this before we hit record, and I've allowed the weather to dictate my coffee game. So, you know, I've got the Mudball Half Calf, of course. I've got the Clubhouse South American Dark Roast, of course. Both of those coming from our friends at Good Walk Coffee. Goodwalkcoffee.com. Use code the tie, TheTie for 20% off anything on the site. Anyway, on the on the warmer days, like, obviously I'm drinking coffee. And third bullshit of the day, iced coffee is bullshit. If you only drink iced coffee, you're not really a coffee drinker. It's okay if you drink it, but you if warm coffee is not hot coffee rather is not in your rotation, then like there's a problem here. So I only drink it warm. And when the weather's a little bit warmer out, for example, today it was like low 80s. You know, I kind of only want one cup of coffee. I'll have like 14 ounces of full calf and then I'm kind of done with it. On the little bit cooler days, more dreary, we had a couple days this week that were not cold by any means, but you know, 60 and kind of overcast. And you know, those days I want to have a coffee in my hand for just more time out of the day. Perfect application for the Mudball Half Calf. Brew up like 32 ounces of that bad boy and just sip it all morning. It's just glorious. So that's kind of how I was breaking out my full versus half calf this week. Water, of course, got some with me right here. Always got to be on the water and the electrolytes. Rolling into my eating. You know, some weeks you just have a craving. There's something that you want. And I usually try, for me, that usually centers around a dinner. I don't get like uber specific breakfast cravings. Breakfast for me is an extremely important meal, but it doesn't get too wild by any means, or very rarely does it. Lunch kind of more of the same. Like, I don't do anything crazy for lunch necessarily, but if I have like a dish or something that I want, it's gonna center around dinner. And all week I'd wanted some noodles, and I love making my own noodles and fried rice and all of those things. Not to say that restaurants can't knock it out of the park, but sometimes that just gets It gets a little too wild if you're not going to the right spot. So, recorded last week with Christian Cavalier. That was our most recent episode to release. Go check that one out if you haven't. In his dirt, he mentioned coconut milk to make coconut rice, which I actually did earlier in the week, which was stellar. So I had some leftover coconut milk. So naturally decided to go with some red curry coconut noodles, a little Thai dinner. Got some crispy chicken thighs going. Some zucchini. Don't sleep on zucchini. That's a great, just kind of like filler vegetable. And that was my filler for this. Zucchini, little red bell pepper. It was absolutely awesome. So I fully scratched that itch on the noodle with some red curry coconut noodles. So that'll wrap up my eating. Rolling into my reading, working through Backroads to March by John Feinstein this week. Loving being back in college basketball season. I know you're not a huge sports guy in general, but I love college basketball. There've been some good games on this week. You know, the college basketball season's weird. It's like we've gotten to this point where they kick things off with a bunch of big games. Like, you have the ACC Big Ten Challenge and all of these different like challenges and sort of sanctioned quasi tournaments that take place at neutral sites. And hey, look, I'm not against it because you get a lot of big games. And so that's like kind of the first five, six, seven games of the season, and then you hit kind of the silly season. Pre-conference play where you're just playing a bunch of like random out of conference games by and large. And then like once we kind of hit the new year, you get into conference play and things start to get exciting. So it's been fun reading about college basketball and also having a lot of those kind of early season good games going on. And that'll wrap up my reading for this week. And rolling into my thinking, I've been thinking about my thinking all day, trying to figure out like what's really been on my dome. And there was so much, but Thanksgiving, it just couldn't quite stay away from Thanksgiving. We've talked about this. It is the best holiday of the year. Fourth mm-hmm. bullshit of the day. Halloween is bullshit. Christmas is a wonderful holiday, but just an objective second fiddle to Thanksgiving. But you know, we got to go more granular than just Thanksgiving. And so I was like, what is really occupying my mind when it comes to Thanksgiving? Well, it's pie. It's goddamn pie. I don't eat pie other than on Thanksgiving Day. Like who goes around eating pie all the time? I think, unfortunately, the answer to that question,
I think we know a few,
entirely too many people. But yeah, I only really eat pie on Thanksgiving, and everyone knows where this is going. We're talking pumpkin pie. Pumpkin pie, I'm not quite throwing the fifth bullshit tag to pumpkin pie of the day. For me, pumpkin pie, purely whether or not I'm eating pumpkin pie, purely comes down to like how good was the savory. If I just went absolutely crazy on the savory, I'll have like two large slices. Don't get me wrong. Like there's an extra satchel in my stomach for dessert when it comes to Thanksgiving in particular. But I'll have a couple nice slices of pecan pie, maybe some apple if that's around or whatever the people are offering. But pumpkin probably doesn't make it to the table. But you know, if I liked the turkey and you know, the rolls were good, but I only had one of those and got amongst the sides, but nothing too crazy. Maybe there will be a small piece of pumpkin pie. It is worth trying out and just kind of proving to yourself year over year, one day a year, that it's pretty overrated, extremely overrated. But that's where I sit on things. Like it's not, I'm not fully saying pumpkin pie is not worth eating. But I am fully saying if you're a pumpkin pie rider, if you're one of those people that thinks that is the Thanksgiving pie, get that shit out of here.
Can I'm going to mention two pies / pie adjacents that we've never talked about here. And that is first, like a chocolate tart of sorts. And the second is apricot pie. How do you feel about either of these?
Pretty lukewarm, if I'm being if I'm being honest. Yeah, neither of those really strike a chord.
Okay, they're both kind of part of my childhood. Like my grandmother on my dad's side made those like growing up, rich, tart, like super great, and I love them. But nonetheless,
key lime pie, by the way, not a Thanksgiving pie, but it's good pie.
Dude, key lime pie, if made at home, is elite.
I think it has some of the best crust out there. That like confusing sort of graham crackery crust for some reason it really jives with the key lime. Well, okay, we got
to
stop this. We're getting into the episode.
One more thing, your haircut looks fucking stellar, man. It's probably the best haircut I've seen in the last 5 years.
Do you want
years.
Full honesty on what's going on with the haircut here?
Yes.
So, it's Friday evening. I'm going home tomorrow I'm going to spend the whole week in the Carolinas. My dad hates when I get a short haircut. So when do I get my haircut? 12 hours before I'm going home. So, happy Thanksgiving.
Oh, that was awesome.
Routing versus ordering. I'm going to let you lead us off here to get a little bit more in the weeds about routing. Like, I think people understand what routing is at a high level, but they probably don't understand the full intricacies of what it takes to go from literally a piece of land to routing. What is the best combination of holes that should be on this land? How should it make it around the land, especially when you have certain landforms? What are the different ways that it's done? I mean, certain architects, to my understanding, love to like get on the ground and they want to go see it. They want to feel it. They want to see golf holes and what it would look like to the eye. And then, I mean, our boy Tommy D, apparently he basically routes golf courses from his office. He's a big topo guy. He can just use the technology and put together a kick-ass routing because he's pretty much as good as they come. So go for it on routing. What interests you there?
There's a lot with routing. As I'm sure you know, and I'm sure everybody else here knows, we could fill up, you know, 24 hours of routing talk with different architects or just between us two, to lay it out generally for our chat today. You know, if you're going to build a golf course, you've got a piece of land. That land has certain assets to it, whether it's, you know, a feature that abruptly moves up or down or sideways, or an ocean or a nook or a cranny, or any number of things. I mean, we live on, sometimes I feel like this is such an incredibly small world, but we live on a big planet and there's a lot of variety in the golf that we play. So there's really no point today in talking about what kind of features we're going to build around. But the first job of a golf course architect, once the scope for the project is kind of set, is the golf course architect is responsible for working with the client, basically saying, you know, how much money are we going to spend? Are we willing to spend on this thing? And then, you know, here's version A, B, C of kind of what we can do with this, you know. And a lot of the best golf that we've seen over the last, you know, 100 years, you know, you're going to get the best result when we kind of say, hey, let's not work against nature. Let's work with nature, right? So one of the things that is super interesting is that you don't need something amazing or incredibly unique to build a great golf course. I mean, you can build a great golf course with a great routing on, you know, gentle rolling hills. And that's where routing becomes very important, is that if you are not given some piece of land that is absolutely miraculous, you do have to be very creative in how you choose to put that 18 holes on the ground to maximize the enjoyment, the ease of the walk, the amount of, you know, camaraderie that golfers can feel returning to certain landmarks, or, you know, the feeling that you get passing certain things and getting a look at them from certain angles and then returning and saying, wow, I see that. We've already experienced that, but I'm seeing it from a whole different angle. So there are lots of things to go into here today, but generally speaking, Henry is going to kind of tackle the ordering of holes. Henry, I liked what you said before. It was like, you know, if you start on hole six, you're going to get an entirely different golf course than you would if you start on hole one or hole 10, right? So my perspective today is going to be kind of focusing on three different ways to route. But even that is wrong. We're going to talk about some golf courses today and kind of how they're routed. And Henry will focus on kind of the ordering of the holes, and I'll focus on why they were delivered and the way they were delivered, if that works. So Henry, let's start here. Obviously for everyone here listening, we all love a dramatic finish. It makes sense, right? It's like you build and build and build, whether you think of this as an album or a movie or whatever, you want a dramatic finish, right? Which means that you have to figure out some way to have the most exciting features on your golf course work into the golf holes on 15, 16, 17, and 18. So the question is, how do you do that? What I'm going to ask you is, what are some golf courses that do that really well? And what do you see in those golf courses?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of how I was going to lead in there. It's like it's like a book or a movie, you know. It's like, you have your I might miss one of these, but in your plot develop, in your story arc, whatever these terms are that you learn back in like elementary school, you know, you have your rising action essentially. And so it's all building up to what will ultimately be the climax of the stories. So that's like your main point. It's not coming at the middle. It's towards the end, but it's not the very end. You're going to have your falling action. Like that, to me, that's important, is like the come down. I think that it's interesting that sometimes you see golf courses. So like, I think Tree Farm is an example of a course, to use one that we talk about all the time, that I think it's a beautiful ordering of holes. The thing that's interesting to me is the climax comes at the 18th tee. And I think that's fantastic. but some of the very, very best. I'm going to Augusta. That's my example because everybody knows it. And I think that the ordering of the holes there is absolutely stellar because you have your clear climax to me on the 16th tee. I think that's like one of the coolest holes out there. It's no hot take, especially well, like, and that's what makes the Masters so magical is like, not only is that kind of the climax of the round 15, 16, but the Sunday hole location is the best one that makes that climax its very best when you've got guys using that slope. I mean, think about like the 2019 Masters and 1986, Tiger in 05, like all of these different times. Like that to me is the moment. But then you do have like the game is not over. There's a clear falling action and a resolution. 17, still an extremely legitimate golf hole. That's when you're starting to see, okay, like now we know what is going on. We know who is in this game, but there's still golf left to be played. And then your resolution, you got to play the 18th. Like 18 is one of, I mean, I think it oftentimes plays as like the hardest par four out there.
And then so, 17 is interesting as well. Cause like 17 is more or less like just, you got to hit two golf shots. And then on 18, you got to hit another two golf shots. 16 the same. I mean, it's just Augusta's mad, dude.
Well, and so like let's flip it all the other way. Like if the nines were reversed and you went out and you played the back nine as the front nine and then you finished on the front nine, there aren't a lot of bad holes out there, so I don't think that it would be some bad golf course. But in terms of the drama and what has made that such an amazing place for the best tournament in the world, so much of it has to do with the way that the course builds 1 to 18, not 10 to 9. And so that's what I mean by ordering is, you know, another example, TPC Sawgrass. So the front nine at Sawgrass, it's like, it's really good. It's straightforward, simple golf. It's a great sort of like, this is what you're going to expect all day. You know, it's like you have to execute. You have to hit into some funky greens and some awkward shots. You're going to have to curve balls in directions that it doesn't feel like you're going to have to. You have some just flat out like, look, it's execution. Like there's a small fairway and you better try to hit it. That's the rising action of the day. It's like showing you what this golf course is going to be about. And then you start to build later into the round with 12 and 13 and 14 and 15. And then once again, it's like 16, 17. There's the climax, but it's not over. Once you get to 17, I mean, that tee shot at 17 is very clearly the climax of that round. However, it's not just like, oh, here you are, hit this shot and you're done. I mean, there have been guys that hit that shot many times. There have been guys that go and three putt that green and get in the bunker and get silly. And there's all sorts of craziness that happens. And then 18, you got to go play it. So I think that when I think about courses that have a really great ordering to the golf holes, it is that like 15, 16, 17, where you really hit that climax, but then it keeps you super engaged coming down the stretch as well. There are more shots to be hit. There's more excitement to be had. You know, there aren't those just, I don't want to use the term sleeper holes. But, you know, like final example here before I kick it back to you. And this is like a consummate debate, frankly. And I sit on the more positive end of this spectrum. I think that the 18th hole at Cypress, I mean, you know, we're not doing ourselves a service here today. We've talked Augusta, Sawgrass, and Cypress once again.
But, you know, Sawgrass has the highest green fee by a lot, actually.
Yeah, by an absolute mile. Cypress is fascinating. It really is fascinating because, once again, 16, like the climax. 17, it's like you almost just have this prolonged climax at Cypress of like 15, 16, 17. It's like everything builds to those three holes and it's truly 60 minutes in heaven that you just do not want to end. And then it's just, I don't even know how to describe it because I personally, I think 18 is at Cypress is a much better hole than a lot of people think, but it almost should be a 17 hole golf course, not because the 18th isn't good, but because it's like, well, what could be good at that point, right? Like what else could live up to that? And you know, what I said a moment ago of like, you want there to still be action. You don't want any sleepers coming down the stretch. Like after 17, unless that's going to be the end of it, I don't know how else we do this. So I don't really know how to situate that one. But what I do know is, once again, when it comes to ordering, if you flip those nines, you'd truly just be like, what are we doing here? And that would be impossible because nine finishes not at the clubhouse. But if 14 was the 18th, I think the 14th hole is awesome. I think it's like maybe the most underrated hole out there. However, once again, if you started on 15, you'd be like, what? Why are we doing this? Why are we starting with literally the sixth hole
and
stuff?
And it's over. You know, it's like,
it's like you go out to Augusta and your first tee shot is 13. You know, and it's like, what? Why are we doing this, fellas?
Ending on 12 would be a wild go, man. Anyways, no, that was great. I want to go back to Augusta briefly, and you know, the nines were flipped at Augusta. Bobby Jones, he originally designed Augusta to be the way that it is, right? 1 to 18 as we know it. And then flipped it. And then it was flipped back. And I started thinking about this a little bit more today, and I was like, okay, well, you know, by and large, 9 and 18 are not that dissimilar, especially with the way that the ninth green was at the time. The ninth green now is a little bit more Fazio, as we should say. Like, it's not a bad green. I actually quite like it, but it had a little bit more of that boomerang, and it, you certainly could have had pins like the one that we've seen so many famous moments at on 18. Now, the question is, and I think the obvious answer is, like, the reason the back nine, the existing back nine at Augusta is so great is because, you know, 10 kicks you in your teeth, 11 kicks you in your teeth, 12, the spread is like, and you could, the numbers back this up too, the spread, like, from the beginning of the week to the end of the week is probably like 7 or 8 shots between, you know, 2 and 10. 13 is your, I don't want to say it's your last real chance, but the spread on 15 is way bigger than it is on 13 as well. You know, 14 is a very real golf hole. 15, you know, unless it's Sunday pin, pretty much your last real chance to bank on a birdie, you know, and 16, just you, if you want to make two there, you've got to hit a great golf shot and a great putt. And if you're there in the afternoon on Sunday, it freaking matters, you know, and doing that is harder than I understand and harder than most people understand. 17, you got to hit two kick-ass golf shots. I mean, if you hit, I guess you can hit a slightly dinky drive, but if you hit two dinky shots in a row, you're probably going to make 5. It's just the way that it is. And then 18, I don't think people realize, I don't think most people realize that, you know, everyone talks about the drive, but you've got to hit, you know, you've got to hit a dead straight 300-yard ball to then have 177 in up the hill, you know, and you can't see the bottom of the flagstick. And, you know, if you're making 4, 2, 4, 3 on those last holes under pressure, like, you've done something incredible. And seeing
shout out our lift boy, Schwartzel, 4-2-3-3 to win the thing going away. What a dog.
That was a good call. I didn't remember it that way.
I low-key picked him that year to win the Masters. I'll always love Schwartzel for that reason. I made a dime off that one.
Good man. So seeing those nines reversed is odd. It's just weird. And then TBC Sawgrass. One thing that is weird about Sawgrass, and Augusta too, but mostly Sawgrass, is that because it's overseeded and because it's the fifth major and because we're so far from that swampland that used to be, I think people forget that, you know, like, they acquired the land for $1. Pete was like a super hard guy to work with, basically. There was this story about the project manager, Vernon Kelly, who he described getting plans from Pete Dye as like pulling teeth, basically. Like, Pete just didn't want to play ball. He just wanted to do what he wanted to do. And it was dead flat. and it was like filled with like, you know, 3-inch thick vines, and you know, they were just like dredging through 3 feet of water. And the constraints on that golf course, you couldn't even sit there and say, oh, I want to take this hole this way because it's strategic. It was like, no, we just have to figure out where the sand is, where to put all this water. And then once we've done those things, then we need to get all these vines out of here, and then we can build a golf course. And I think people forget that because Sawgrass is so pretty now. And it was not the first question that had to be asked was not like, you know, well, how do we make this strategic? It was like question number five. And
kind of like how, not what, you know, it's like you start with just like, how on earth are we going to get this done?
Exactly.
And then we go from there.
I mean, there were people that were saying, you know, they bought the land for $1, and people were saying like, even still, you overpaid for it. That's like a shitty deal. Like, you just inherited this horrible property. And the whole reason that 17 and 18 came into play, and, you know, they seem so strategic now and like part of this really exciting finish. And obviously that was part of the conversation, but the lakes on or ponds on 17 and 18, that was where all the sand was, you know, and they had to sand cap those fairways to make it like a decent golf course. And they were like, well, we're going to have to extract all this sand. So these are probably going to be ponds. And it was Alice Dye who had the idea. She was like, I guess we have to do an island green now. And, you know, such a different, totally different from Augusta, where Bobby Jones was like, I want to build my club, right? Like, let's go find some land. And, you know, they found this field land, you know, in a suburb of Atlanta, and they built the thing, and it was really hard, but it was not Sawgrass, totally different thing. But both have incredibly dramatic finishes, and they're arguably, you know, like a top 10, top 5, top 7 event, professional golf every year. Very different. So, Henry, do you want to jump into, I guess, I'll let you take it here. Where do you want to take it from here?
I want to go backwards here a little bit. I have a question for you that kind of led off of what you started with, but pulls these two together pretty nicely. So in your experience in studying golf courses and being involved with golf courses and all the rest, speaking with people who have built golf courses, how often is it when it comes to routing and then ultimately ordering, how often is it that a key feature in a piece of property is identified early as, okay, we want this to, it's very clear that this is going to be kind of the centerpiece of this property. And for that reason, we want holes X, Y, and Z to be in that part of the ordering. And then ultimately the routing and ordering lead off of that. I didn't do a good job explaining that, but for example, let me just describe it a little bit better. Let's say that there's a very key ridge throughout a golf course, and an architect says, okay, this is kind of our key feature, and I want holes 15 and 16 to go up and back over this ridge. In your experience, does that happen a lot? Or how do those two things start to inform the way routing and ordering of a golf course come together?
I have not read Getting to 18 by Tom Doak. It's a limited edition book. I've never gotten my hands on it. I'm sure somebody listening to this owns it. If you do, I'd love to read it. And that book has a lot of the answers to that question. And I do think there's a really good answer out there. It, as far as what's in my mind, the majority of those courses to me seem to be modern. Like a lot of the older golf courses that I think of, in the Northeast or whatever were, you know, they remind me of some of the best food in the world. It was like, it often started as like poverty food in a way. Like, you were just trying to make the thing work, and it was so good and so sought after and so functional that it was appreciated by the masses. And that's what I think a lot of Northeast golf is. But like, what comes to mind is not St. Lucia, the Cabot,
Cabot Cliffs.
Cabot Cliffs, right? Of course you want to build on that ridgeline. Like, that's the whole reason you pick the site. And to have those final holes playing up against the side of that ridge is like, that's modern ingenuity and foresight and having the coin and the balls to pick a site, you know, that far away from, you know, modern society. And I think that's cool. I think about St. Lucia, like, frankly, the stuff Cabot's doing right now is bonkers. But I would love to give you an older answer, and I don't have one coming to mind. However, Bandon's obviously a great example, but these are all kind of in the same theme, which I hate. I'd love to give you a better example that was just real and raw. Old Head, maybe. Old Head golf links, not the best golf architecture in the world, but wow, incredible site that is. That being said, going back to my original point, I think there does not have to be I think our standard for what a significant or beautiful or amazing feature is like crazy inflated. I think very ordinary slopes, ridges, or just like pitches of land with the right architect and the right, you know, experience can produce like some crazy good golf. And it's been seen over and over and over and over. And hell, a lot of that was seen in Scotland just as a byproduct of people saying, hey, let's find a flat spot to putt here. And you just have people play it for 50 years and they figure out the best paths. And when mowers started, you know, to maintain golf courses, they just kind of mowed it as people had played it for 50 years. And that, I think, that's the cool shit. So I wish I had a better answer for your question. But the answer to your question is, features do not have, I think we overinflate what a great feature is.
Yeah, you mentioned band in there, and I think that has a interesting intersection with this conversation. So I've read Dream Golf, which is the book that the Kaisers put together on Bandon and just kind of their overall view of it. But it started with Bandon, clearly. And first course at Bandon is, of course, Bandon Dunes, the David McClay kid course. And I think that the, you know, we went back, we talked earlier about how there's the climax and there's the falling action, and there's the resolution. And I think a lot of people would look at Bandon Dunes, and there's debate when the course was built of, well, of course you're going to put the clubhouse out on the cliffs. And Mike Kaiser's reaction to that was, no, I want the best golf to be out on the cliffs. And so I thought it was a really elegant way to do things, to say, okay, well, we want, you know, the climax of the course, the 16th, which this is a deeper conversation that we're not having today. I'm calling bullshit on the 16th at Bandon. And I think a lot of that had to do with the time that I've only played that during the US Amateur, and they had it so damn firm that the hole just did not work. The hole did not work. And if it wasn't so firm, I see how, like aesthetically, it's an amazing hole. But I'm like, look, at the end of the day, I don't care what a hole looks like. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. So we're not going to go too deep on that one. But anyway,
I remember you can't. I remember talking about
it. It can't not
that.
Come out of my dome when I think of the 16th. But the 16th is undoubtedly a super neat hole. And I think that to build that hole out there as the 16th, rather than put the clubhouse out there or to have the 18th out there, kind of brings this thing full circle to show that the ordering and the routing of holes do have an extremely important intersection to what the overall experience becomes.
Totally agree. I'm curious kind of what you feel about different styles of routings. Like, we talked about some of the, I guess the big name resorts, whatever, like Bandon. I want to get away from the Cabots and the Bandons and whatever. You have been to St. Andrews, correct?
I have not played. I've been.
Okay. But have you walked the course?
I've seen many of the holes, have not walked the whole thing.
Okay, got it. Well, I mean, what about Kiawah? Have you played or been on the ocean course?
Yeah.
I mean, those two courses to me are fairly similar, right? And like, I think I'm correct here in saying that Bandon Dunes itself is not either an out and back or a figure eight. Like, it does have some inland holes, or is it all on the cliffs?
No, it's not all on the cliffs. Like there, it kind of starts away, and I mean, you can kind of see it the whole way.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, they're only four, five, six of the holes that are like truly kind of right out there.
Right. So instead of talking about, like, you mentioned a central feature you're trying to, like, highlight on the routing so that the golfer can experience it. Let's talk about, like, a land constraint, right? If you are on Kiowa, for example, like, of course you have a piece of land that's on the ocean. You want to experience as much of it as you can, but you do have one big problem, and that's that you're going to get, most likely, if you don't put a whole lot of thought into it, you're going to get 9 holes ish with the same wind direction, and like 9 holes ish with the other same wind direction. And so there's kind of a challenge there. St. Andrews is not exactly this way. They're both genius routings in their own way, but I'm curious what you think about order there. You've played the ocean course. You know a lot about the old course at St. Andrews. What are the differences, similarities that you see there? What do you take interest in?
It's a great question because those are just it's the old course, excuse me, the ocean course in particular really does come to mind and being such a brilliant figure eight sort of routing because yeah, like so many links courses, it's like 1-9 is all one wind direction and 1-9 is all the other. And I do have a bit of a qualm with that. Like I've had multiple links experiences where don't get me wrong, the course is fantastic. It's an awesome time, but you end up hitting the same shot over and over and over because the hole is the same direction. The wind is an extremely important part of that whole experience of golf. And so, for example, you'll see five straight holes that go straight into the wind, and you have a central sort of feature hazard on the golf course. And so, let's say five straight holes, it's trouble right, and the wind is into and off the left. And it's just back foot low punch drivers that you're trying to make not go right the whole time, and you're just kind of hitting that same shot over and over. And so I think that's what makes the ocean course so neat to have that sort of figure eight where, and I haven't played it recently enough to be able to say where you go with the wind direction. I want to say you start into, but I could certainly be wrong there. But you kind of start, let's say you do start into, you play about four holes into. You go along the side, you play a couple holes that cross, you then play down for, I guess, eight or so. I might struggle with my math here. But then, you kind of have a long run of it to get all the way out to the other side of the figure eight. You come back in and then you go the other direction. And so you switch off more with that wind direction than you would with the traditional links. And those are the sorts of intricacies of routing that become so fascinating, to sit there and say, okay, this is a coastal golf course. Wind is a big part of this. We don't want it to be just the traditional nine into the wind, nine downwind. How do we get around that? It's just great stuff. Now, when that comes to ordering, I don't have a ton of passion on this subject necessarily when it comes to the ocean course. I think the ordering is really good. I'm just sitting here thinking on the fly, if you flipped it, both nines I think are really interesting. I probably just because it's how it is, I say, yeah, just leave it the way they have it right now. But the course would be really, it'd be a really interesting one if you played it the other direction. You think about it, like the eighth hole, that long par three, that'd be a great 17th. The ninth hole is more than stout enough to be a finisher as your, if that were to be the 18th, they would have changed some things if they meant it to be the other way with the way that the clubhouse sits right back behind the 18th, they just would have flipped it and it would sit right back behind the ninth, but it's kind of right there anyway. So yeah, it's a good question, but that's a great call out on a course with just a super interesting routing. I want to throw another course at you here. We haven't talked about this one, but what do you know about Muirfield? That's another interesting routing that takes a very different sort of approach to how to make golf interesting when you have a central feature such as wind and not have the round become too monotonous.
Yeah, Muirfield's interesting. I haven't played it, haven't been over there, but I know a decent amount about it. I like the idea, and I like the idea of kind of the going around the perimeter of the property, and then
The horseshoe
and
routing.
the horseshoe in a way. Like you get your bearings. You see there's kind of this exploration on the front side, But because there's hardly any trees or anything, you're getting your bearings, and then by the time you make the turn after lunch, you kind of experience the middle of the golf course. And if you look at Muirfield like from an aerial or something, it does, in a way, very different landforms, of course. But it reminds me of Shinnecock, like as far as how nearly every direction of the hole, each hole is just totally different. And I have no idea what the wind direction is, but the way people talk about Muirfield, not just the experience, but obviously the quality of the golf, the championship golf that's been played there, plus what I've seen on the aerials. It's a really interesting concept to me. And I've seen this a couple other places, and I'm not sure if these are great comparables, but I was thinking about the tree farm routing today. And I was like, it's not exactly a horseshoe. And clearly a lot of thought went into that routing, but you really don't spend, there's no time wasted in a single nook of the property. I mean, you were just constantly moving around it almost in a spiral until you get back to the clubhouse. And what a fascinating way to experience, I don't know how many acres the tree farm is, but really cool and very similar. And then you look at Cyprus, like you kind of make your way to the southeastern portion of the property, and then you work all the way around, and kind of on the interior of the golf course to the cliffs and then back to the clubhouse. It's not exactly the same, but it's the same theme. And I find, I mean, you look at just the way people view those four golf courses, five golf courses, and you're like, yeah, that's pretty good. So I think they're doing something right.
Last
Tell me
question of the
about,
day.
oh, I want to hear your take on Shinnecock, because I know it's one of your favorite golf courses. The US Open was there. People have seen golf played on that course. I've never been out there, but it looks stout. What if they
Oh.
flipped? What if you started on hole three?
Yeah, another good question, and honestly, another course where like 9 and 18 at Shinnecock to me are one and the same is the wrong way to put it, but they're very similar. Long par fours, they come up to just the awesome clubhouse up on top of the hill. And the course is so stout in and of itself. Like, we talked about earlier how you wouldn't want to start on the sixth hole and finish on the fifth. And I'm not saying you would at Shinnecock either, but certain golf courses, Oakmont would be another example of this, where it's like every hole's like hard. And clearly there are a few holes that are meant to be the finishers based on where they literally finish with regard to the clubhouse and all of those things. But like you could kind of start wherever and it's going to be just a difficult and interesting round altogether. That would be a great candidate for flipping, I would say.
It's like a sum of the parts routing type thing.
I threw out Oakmont. Like, I don't think of that course. So here's the way I would put it when it comes to courses like Shinnecock and Oakmont. Like there's like running a marathon, and then there's boxing, whereas like running a marathon, you know what to expect the whole way through. It's like you're gonna start out, you're gonna feel really, really, you never feel good at the beginning of a run, and then you're gonna hit kind of the third mile or so, and you're just gonna cruise for a really long time. And then you're going to hit like the 15th mile, and it's going to start to get like pretty hard. And then you're going to hit the 21st mile, and it's going to get really, really hard. And you're just going to try to hold on and finish, but you kind of know what to expect. That's what like a lot of golf courses are. It doesn't necessarily mean that they have that increasing level of difficulty, but you kind of know what it's going to be. A boxing match, you simply are just walking around trying to not take an absolute haymaker at any moment. And that's kind of what it feels like playing Shinnecock and Oakmont. There is no sitting here thinking about like, let me conserve some energy for the back, the back nine or like the last handful of holes out here. It's like, no, man, like if I make a quad on the third hole, who cares how I'm playing on 17 anyway? You're truly fighting every single hole in and of itself. And so that's how I think of those courses more so. Is it's just like it's so draining to play them because every hole is so difficult that I almost step away from routing and ordering. You know, it's kind of a funky way to look at it.
Yeah, that's cool too, though. I like that.
But straight off the dome, that's what it feels like playing those places. So, okay, last question of the day for you. This is an important one. We did talk about Thanksgiving earlier. Yeah. Route in order a plate of food for me for Thanksgiving.
Oh, dude, this is so good.
So the route is what, you know, what's on the plate. Like that is your property. That's your canvas. You have to put golf holes. You have to put food on that plate. But then there's a very clear and important order in which these things should be consumed. There's an order that a golf course needs to be played in. How do you route and order your Thanksgiving meal?
Okay, thank you. What a wonderful question this is. I've said this before on the pod, and I know I'm insane for it, but I look forward to it every year, and I look forward to it again in a couple of days. One of my favorite things to eat at Thanksgiving is white and or wild rice with my grandmother's gravy. She collects pan drippings throughout the year and makes the most ridiculously flavorful gravy I've ever had. It's like, it's pretty thin, but it's incredibly flavorful. And a shit ton of thinly sliced green onions. One of my favorite dishes of the year. That is not only going on my plate first, but it's usually getting consumed first, which arguably really bad take because you don't want to go for the carbs first. You want to go for, it's like the ribs first or something. Okay. Next. I go ribs, then I go turkey. I like light meat and dark meat. I choose both. I choose to have both. Like summer peas, really nice. We don't do them up heavy. It's not like a casserole situation. It's just like chicken broth and maybe a little bit of butter. Very, very good. Kind of like earthy Sean Brock type vibe. I go for a little bit of stuffing every year. Our family does, like basically like oyster stuffing, which is, I don't know if that's traditional or not, but that's what we do. And I like it. Okay. I feel like I should like it more than I do, but I always have a little bit.
I'm a stuffing guy. Stuffing is like the definition of you eat it literally once a year, but I thoroughly enjoy it.
Yeah, it's good. I'm curious to kind of hear what you guys do with stuffing. But I eat it with hot sauce. I eat it with Frank's Red Hot. I don't know why, but I just do. I love it.
Anything can be eaten with hot sauce.
It's true. That would be my order. And then to close, I mean, of course, we're doing that same thing like again, you know? So I don't know if I love like playing the same golf course twice in a row, but hey, that's kind of what we did. And then of course, to finish, I finish with a slice of apple pie, which would be kind of like, you know, we're really encroaching on something great here, something profound. But
climax,
really,
if you will, that's probably the climax,
if you will. But you're still very much moving vertically, right? You have not yet reached the peak where you're starting to tip. And where that moment takes place is with the pecan pie and a little bit of ice cream if you fancy that sort of thing. I'm actually not as much into the ice cream. I generally don't love hot and cold things like coexisting together, which also may be insane. But that is how I like to cut it.
So I think what I'm hearing from you is the procession of apple to pecan. That is your great 16th hole, but it's like pecan is the green. That's where, when you take that first bite of pecan, is where you have fully reached the climax. But then as you make it through that first piece of pecan pie, you're now clearly into the falling action. And then the resolution is finally, okay, fuck this. I'm going back for another piece. It's game over. We're going to be horizontal here very quickly.
Yes.
Cut it.
Yes. I mean, think about your best golf memories, right? Hopefully, after a golf experience and hopefully a really great meal, you find yourself at some point in the night either exhausted and happy, exhausted, full and happy, exhausted, full, drunk and happy, and tired. And you find yourself just like horizontal on a couch hanging out with the guys, and you got nothing left to give. And those are the best moments ever. It means you had a great day. Being exhausted at the end of the day means you had a great day. So that's what that means.